Yo, Panta. Split.
You my dad.
Kelly on a beat, boy.
Been ain't a long talking.
Welcome to the New York Times Podcast. You are five mics. You're A+. You're 10 out of 10. Your critics pick. Music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Tell them one up. Brand new UK day. I must get one up. Send one up before the sun come up. Venezuela link for the put up. Them come to see and kiss Dallas. Please, I get turn up. We cover you, my dad.
We're going to talk this week about music criticism and what is it good for. So something happened about a week and a half ago. I was traveling to Las Vegas to review U2 at Sphere, which is the new immersive performance venue that opened up, and U2's concert, and they're having a residency there that was inaugurating the space. As I was traveling, I wasn't paying that much attention to Twitter. And when I came back over the weekend, Twitter was aflame with a conversation about music criticism and record reviews and the utility of them, and also the increasingly fraught economic environment for solid music journalism and music criticism. This is, of course, compounded by layoffs at a few websites and podcast companies and audio companies, etc. And one of the things that was discussed was how much energy critics should give to relatively unknown artists. And if you have a sort of limited amount of time and resources, should you be covering big things or small things? And it was not lost on me that I was in Las Vegas covering a U2 concert at Sphere. Not to say that there's not merit in that, but the pure amount of time that an event like that takes, and the labor of getting there and preparation and then attendance and staying up all night and so on and so forth got me thinking a little bit. So, for example, at the beginning of this episode, we were listening to Mad Dogs. That's a new single by Byron Messiah. I wrote about it in our playlist a few weeks ago. It's a good example of a song by an artist who is innovating in a genre. And I think there's an opportunity to think wider and deeper about the types of things that are happening in dancehall right now. And Byron Messiah, obviously, it's nice to write 100 words or 200 words about the song, but I think it does feel like the tip of the iceberg. And that's just one recent example of something that I've written about or touched on, but I really feel like there's so much more to say. Not to say that U2 is not a worthy band, not to say that Sphere is not a worthy venue, not to say that U2 at Sphere was not the opportunity to write incisive music criticism. I like to think that I did so, but it did get me thinking about my time, the limited resource of my time, and the ways in which I would optimally like to spend it and to use the knowledge and platform that I have. And it really, that thought process very much dovetailed with what I saw on Twitter when I was looking after I came back and thinking hard about why I got into this game, what I hope to contribute to it and derive from it as a consumer and reader and listener. It got me thinking we should have a conversation, not just simply about music reviews or music criticism, but the bigger topics at hand. So this week, we're going to have a conversation with Jamie Brooks. Jamie was the person whose tweet set this conversation in motion. But I also think in subsequent episodes of podcast later this year, we're going to pick up on some looser threads in the music journalism and music criticism space, that things I've been sitting on or people I've wanted to talk to, and there maybe hasn't been the exact opportunity or moment to bring them on the show. But I think they might capture a new idea or a new approach to how this thing is being done now and how it might be done in the future. Keep an ear and an eye out for that coming later in the year. We'll revisit these ideas. You know, we've talked about this stuff a lot before, but I think now, especially with what's happening in the business climate for music writing, now's a real important time to put these conversations to the fore. In the meanwhile, let's start it off. There was one particular tweet that set off a lot of conversation, and that came from Jamie Brooks. Jamie is @EliteGs_GZ. Jamie, welcome to Popcast.
Hi, long time listener, first time caller.
So happy to have you. I've been wanting to have you for a really long time. If you're not up on Jamie, let me get you up on Jamie. Jamie Makes Music, Elite Gymnastics, Default Genders, writes a column for the New Inquiry, has a Substack. Maybe it's dormant, the Substack.
Well, no, I'm working on the big year in review thing for the Substack. It's just like it comes in big, intense bursts rather than smatterings of small bursts.
That's my preferred rate of output, the occasional burst.
I write for the heads, the big, sustained, intense burst heads.
I'm with that. So get involved in the Substack. And I think crucially, look, we all know Twitter, X, formerly known as Twitter, is largely a...
Not calling it that.
Nope. We're just called... Look, y'all know what I'm talking about. We know it's a wasteland. We know it's hard. We know it's hard to have real conversation. Jamie, you systemically find a way to have earnest, thoughtful, provocative, non-judgmental conversation, or at least to initiate such things on that platform, that forsaken platform, which I am grateful for, because most days I wish not to look at it at all. Maybe let's just start quickly with what led you to share this notion about how music publications should cover music, frankly.
One of my pet projects that I like to write about and think about with regard to the music industry is the extent to which things have changed since streaming took over as the dominant mode of consumption. We went from an industry that was about selling music directly to consumers to selling consumers access to music, which is like very different. And I'm of the opinion that like the base determines the superstructure, the underlying economic situation of the music business is going to affect like what things actually sound like. When there was a market for ringtones in the late aughts, like that affected the kind of music that was being made. So I like to think about how the way music is consumed now is going to affect what it actually sounds like. And the biggest thing since streaming took over is that people pay less for music now. I think recorded music has become intensely devalued. It's not worth as much as it was. Like I don't think to the average streaming subscriber, an album is worth $10 anymore. And I don't think to the average streaming subscriber, a song is worth $1 anymore. I think that people are used to paying less than that. And so there's a pervasive sense like in the market and in culture that like these things are just not worth as much as they used to be.
And also, I mean, just on a pure dollar sense, if we're talking $10 album as a purchase, that is what it costs for 1 month of access at a major streaming service to, I don't want to say the entire library of recorded music, because we know that that's not true, but to a vast library of recorded music, but it is rented access.
Yes, it's unbeatable value for money in the format it currently exists relative to what we had before. And I think that recordings being worth less makes me think about how a lot of the paid writing about music that goes on these days is fixated on evaluating recordings. I release stuff exclusively on Bandcamp, and in terms of the raw numbers like being sold, it's not a heck of a lot. And yet, like every time I come out, like there's usually some thoughtful, critical discussion of my music, which I'm grateful to see. But I also, it makes me wonder, like, where's the party? Like there used to be like the record reviews, I feel like, used to be like the top layer of something much deeper that included radio and alt weeklies and like all this infrastructure that has been really hollowed out over the last 20 years of media consolidation and like the techification of everything. So I think that's really changed the underlying factors of music a lot. And I wonder if recordings are really, I wonder if the market would say that recordings merit the attention that is currently being paid to them by writers. And I started to kind of imagine the resource of the talent of all the people that are currently writing about music. I started to imagine like other places that those gifts might go, like other types of writing that they might be applied to. And like, I didn't say that should replace album reviews, but I think because of what's been going on in digital media over the past like several years, any kind of challenge, perceived or otherwise, to the viability of the album review is going to make people nervous, because that's one of the last paid jobs that's left. I think it's hard for a lot of writers to imagine what music writing would be if it wasn't predicated on recordings being really important, albums being really important.
We have to talk about how we arrived at this situation, right? I mean, we think about it's not just a pitchforkification of music coverage, but it's also, I mean, this is how Rolling Stone functioned for many years and functioned from the 70s onwards. This is how Spin Magazine, The Village Voice, Entertainment Weekly, kind of capsulization of reviews, like the notion that a smart person could take on an idea as encapsulated by an album in a condensed space became central to what people thought music criticism should be increasingly throughout the 90s, 2000s and into the internet era. That is a norm that I think is intensely tied in with how were music magazines funded. Like often they were funded by advertising, by record labels, putting out ads for albums that they also wanted to see reviewed in the editorial copy. These things live side by side. But when you kick out the chair leg and say record labels they're not going to advertise with you anyway. That's not at all what's happening here. There's no funding there. On some level, music publications never changed any approach. Not that you have to be guided by where the advertising dollars come from, of course, but it never changed the approach to second guess. Should that be prime in the coverage? I feel like we still haven't had that conversation, which is why I was so fascinated by the discourse that got kicked off by what you were saying.
Yeah, I think that there was a lot of insecurity that was provoked by that tweet, and that wasn't my intention. And like, I like a lot of contemporary working music writers. I read Pitchfork. Like, I don't read the other sites as much. But yeah, like, I think that, like, you mentioned Rolling Stone and Spin and like the publications we think about in terms of the imperial era of the album, the Rolling Stone 60s, Dion Warwick type era. And I think also the physical formats, they kind of sustained, like, you know, like over in the UK, you had the post-punk thing, which was to read the literature and the writing that's been done about that period. It seems like the critics and the musicians were like in kind of a feedback loop with each other, where they were feeding into the energy that was driving people to the writing and to the records being put out by a lot of those indie labels that showed up around that time.
Who often would find, especially on the indie side, would find their kind of most intense cheerleading coming from writers of record reviews. You can't undervalue what a positive review, at least in that era, could do for a relatively lesser known artist in terms of visibility.
Yeah, I'm a big skeptic of the idea these days, at least, that reviews really move the needle on exposing people to new music, especially smaller stuff. But I think it seems inarguable that back then, the print publications and the physical records being put out by those cartels of indie labels over there, that it really was like contributing, the writing about it, like the reviews and the critical enthusiasm for things really were like making a difference for that music and contributed to the fact that we all remember it, even though the actual amount of records being sold at that time is not a heck of a lot.
Minuscule, relatively. A question from that, asking Jamie the musician this question. You said that every time you put out a record, it will get reviewed, it will get taken seriously, a conversation will get started about the music that you are making. Does that not constitute, in your mind, moving the needle? Because without those reviews, would you be in a worse position vis-a-vis your music if it wasn't being discussed in this format every time you put a record out?
I'm a weird person to ask about this because I feel like my relationship to the press is so unlike any, you know, like 10 years ago in 2013, I put out like a Bandcamp exclusive EP, no label, no manager, no publicist, like literally like $0 spent making or promoting the thing. And it became like everybody ran pieces about it, like op-eds, like roundtable discussions. Like it was, the specifics of why that happened are complicated and probably not worth getting into. But back I think like the main underlying factor that I think allowed that to be possible back then is that was 2013. That was the peak of digital download sales. Digital download sales grew tremendously over the course of the aughts after Apple introduced the iTunes store and got all the major record labels to consent to having their stuff available there. And it kept growing and growing all through the back half of the aughts, which was also the ringtone era. There was a lot of different money that was being made off digital music at that time. And it peaked in like 2012, 2013. And so at that time, time, like it was sort of a weird moment where I think people like it seemed plausible that like a Bandcamp exclusive release could be important, like in a broader way or warrant discussion, like on that broader way. But then like over time, like I released music a couple more times, like as the decade wore on, in the middle of the transition to streaming and then like after the transition to streaming. And my own personal experience is just that things radically changed as far as that market. I think Jamie, the artist, has had a really hard time with me considering all these things, trying to write about the economic stuff, the financial incentives, because I like albums. Like, you know, like I think like the part of the reason why this culture around albums and discussing them like continues to exist is because like artists really like recording. Like most artists that I've known in a variety of different genres and walks of life, like their favorite part of it is recording. And I think that a lot of artists also really like at least the idea that the work is going to be discussed and something's going to happen with people paying attention to it and trying to tease meaning out of it and letting it into their own lives. Like all that stuff is why artists do what they do. And I think it was for the past several years when there was a period of time where I was focusing more on music again. And during that time, it was really hard for me to consider like you used the image of the chair leg getting kicked out for me to consider. Like, what does my relationship with music look like if the album stops being such a thing? Like, if it's no longer taken for granted that the album is important, that like recordings are important? What if we have reached like a saturation point, or like if there is something deeply wrong with the mechanics, like deep in the machine that it's supposed to make albums matter in culture? If there's some kind of big problem here and there's going to be like a big change, like, how am I going to deal with that? What's it going to feel like for me? How am I going to adjust or adapt? And when I was actively working on music, it was really hard to answer those questions. But then I stopped and pivoted to writing, and it became clear to me like really quickly that something had changed with the way that like music is valued by people, by the listeners. The kind of relationship that the listeners have with music today is not the same relationship that I had with recordings like when I was younger and still buying CDs.
How much of this is also about genre and scene? Because I feel like a lot of times when I think about some of the most meaningful music of my childhood, whether it's hip hop mixtapes, 12 inches, certain scenes, certain dance music scenes, dance hall, stuff like that, these are things that were almost never considered seriously with quote unquote record reviews or critical establishment. And I wonder how much of what we're talking about is actually applicable cross genre, cross scene to all styles of music, and how much of what we're talking about is really a particular subset of music that was in this kind of feedback loop, as you talked about, especially in the British system, for example, but isn't this feedback loop with a certain kind of writer? What is there some line here? Some things are on one side of it and some musics and scenes are on the other side of it historically. Obviously, a lot's changed in the last 10 years. I think I'm thinking more in the 80s, 90s, 2000s.
Yes. And this gets to something that I'm really interested about all this, which is the role of singles. But the answer to the question you just asked is complicated because, like, on one hand, like, there is, like, this underclass of music in the post-punk tradition or in the tradition of small, niche, experimental punk labels, drone labels, whatever. That's part of the discussion and the fixation on albums that happens. But then there's also, like, the superstars. Like, they still, you know, operate in the album format. And in fact, like, those big blockbuster albums, like Midnights or Utopia, or there's maybe a dozen of them every year. That's the mainstream record industry, like the major labels, like preferred way of working. When the transition to albums from singles happened in the first place, like back in the late 60s and the 70s, that was because like just the economics of selling albums like made more sense for the labels, like it was a higher margin item. You could simply charge more for it. And then like when we get into CDs, then it's literally the same disc. They're not even different size discs anymore. So why would you sell singles, which you can only charge so many dollars for, and not albums, which are perceived to be these prestigious, important objects, and therefore you can charge like $20 a pop for them. I think because the transition to albums in the first place was something that was like economically engineered, I think something that we have to look at with the floor falling out from underneath the music that you're talking about that exists in the post-punk tradition, the indie experimental, like, you know, I've seen some people call it NPR core type music, which I was amused by. the floor dropping out from under that stuff, like it might have something to do with the diminished importance of singles and the kind of like hollowing out of like the singles marketplace. That late aughts time period when ringtone rap was happening and there were, you know, like rap mixtapes, like what DJ Drama was trying to do with his own warehouse. While that stuff was going on, you also had a lot of indie acts coming along on indie labels that were putting up like bananas first week numbers while on tiny indie labels. Grizzly Bear, Phoenix, like the Dirty Projectors. And I think like a lot of that stuff, like if you look back on like what caused them to, you know, sell so many records, like they had songs that were competing in the singles marketplace that existed because of the iTunes store and the rising amount of digital purchases and like arguably the piracy ecosystem that kind of like existed behind and underneath and around the above ground digital marketplace. Maybe the singles have always been like a better target to try to hit, not just for dancehall, hip hop mixtapes, like all of those scenes and ecosystems that you were mentioning that exist outside the NPR core continuum. But I think it also might be better for the bands inside the NPR core continuum. I think it actually might be better for like, you know, smaller acts with less resources, like on independent labels, to be trying to make like a great song that's going to, you know, get everybody's attention rather than trying to make like an album where you're being compared to and getting graded on the same scale as like the biggest and most powerful artists in all of recorded music.
And for clarity, are you saying that in the 2023 context, or are you saying that's how it should have been in the 2000s as well?
I think that singles did motivate what caused so many people to get into those indie bands and also all kinds of other music, like in the late aughts. In the 2010s, like when the digital download market was replaced by the streaming economy, we underwent like a transition. The pro rata model that Spotify uses to decide who gets money, it's like your average person, like, you know, like you could get on Spotify and spend all day long listening to small, tiny acts. And there's still no guarantee that any of that money is going to go to them. Most of the money is going to go probably to the biggest acts on the platform, because that's like what Spotify's model exists to do. There's a lot of clustering and consolidation at the top. There's been like the emergence of these a couple of years ago, like the Forever hits, the Shallow catalog hits, that Ed Sheeran song and Blinding Lights by the Weeknd, like these songs that just stuck around in the charts and in the Spotify top songs list like forever, because like the something about like the way that streaming works and the economic incentives of streaming, it causes things to slow down. It causes attention and plays to consolidate around like big superstar artists. I think we underwent a transition that's very similar to what happened in the 70s, like when FM radio formats stopped being freeform and started being consolidated into the AOR format, the album-oriented rock format. The labels loved it because it helped them sell like albums that a lot of the albums that were selling in that period of time. If you go back to the trades and look at what they were advertising, it's we don't remember a lot of that stuff because it wasn't very good. There was actually like a huge recorded music like crash in 1979 because people got tired of like the low quality product that the major labels were flooding the market with. This was before there was the new technology of CD to steal the thunder away. It's like CDs bailed the industry out. And a lot of the money that was being made by from CDs was like people buying old records that they already had on vinyl again.
Yeah, and basically telling people if you like such and such artist and maybe you like two songs, actually that those two songs are most likely they're worth $19.99, not a dollar or $3. That's so just extracting false value for as long as possible.
Yeah, it caused a crash then and it caused another crash like in the early aughts, arguably. And so I think like the radio format, like everything streamlining and consolidating in the 70s, the AOR format is emblematic of that. I think it really put a lot of emphasis on albums and on big superstars. And I think in the last half of the 2010s, there's a really similar thing happening where everything got like really consolidated at the top because of the way streaming works.
Taking your idea in the tweet seriously, right? And I want to think about it through a lens of something that I've thought about a lot over the course of the last 10 years, because I don't review nearly as many albums, qua album, as I did when I first started this job, which was 15 years ago. And partially that's just because on some level, my energies are pulled in other directions that aren't individual pieces of criticism. But also I think especially in the genres that I care most about, I feel like I began to see the album as less and less a statement of artistic intent and sometimes as a business necessity. You're a rapper, you're thrived through three singles, you have to put out an album on the back of that, that frankly, most people aren't going to listen to the full album. They're still listening to it for the singles, and especially in the streaming era, where those are the songs that get continually playlisted over and over and over again, the album, the rest of the album is just some long tail capture of ambient interest, but is not necessarily, doesn't always feel designed for maximum creative cohesion. And there have been a couple of ways, I think, especially that hip hop albums have responded to the kind of imperatives of this era. On the one hand, I think you have very short albums to make people play the whole album and then therefore rack up the number of streams. That's its own kind of creative response. But then on the other side, I remember writing a few years ago about a Post Malone album and like a Ray Schremmert album. And I was like, damn, these are 60 minutes and they seem like one long song. And I feel like they were made with the idea of like, how do I prevent someone from pressing stop? How do I hornswoggle a listener to just keep it on? Those seem like the creative responses to this particular conundrum. No artistic gesture is totally pure, but like those felt like artistic gestures driven by the specifics of the streaming marketplace.
100%. Like, I think like the streaming recommendation algorithms, like they tend to drive you, like if you go on there, like listening to like less well-known stuff, like it's going to suggest like the more well-known stuff, like it filters you in that direction. So I think like these albums are designed to capture that traffic and keep it locked down for as long as possible, like 60, 70, 80, 90 minutes. One of the subplots that I love on podcasts is like the acknowledgement of the influence of Drake. And I think Drake figured that out like really early on. And there's a lot of people that are making albums like Post Malone. Like I think it's these long kind of samey albums that are not like annoying like pop music was in the radio era. Like in the radio era, pop songs had to be annoying because they were only going to get played like a certain amount of times or for a certain period of time before getting taken out of rotation. So they had to be front loaded to make the maximum first impression. And I think once the switch over to streaming happens in 2015, 2016, like almost immediately you see stuff start showing up on the charts that is like going in the opposite direction, that is trying to be something that is more laid back and moody and like emotionally ambiguous. So it can like serve as the backdrop for a variety of different situations. And like oftentimes, like it's filled with lyrical Easter eggs that reveal themselves over the course of multiple listens because they want you listening to it multiple times. One of the reasons why Taylor Swift started streaming so well with the Folklore era is because she wrote like denser, less annoying songs than she had been. And that ended up being perfect. The other big example in pop music is Ariana Grande, like where the Sweetener album, which had lots of Max Martin songs on it. That song Breathe In is probably one of the best things he's had his name on in the past like 7 or 8 years. But that's not the album that brought her into the next level up in the pop culture firmament. Thank You Next was, which was like a moodier, more lyrically focused album. Like, you know, on previous Ariana Grande records, like you couldn't understand anything she was saying. And on Thank You Next, like you were supposed to know what she was saying. The appeal of the song is predicated on the idea that you care like about who these ex-boyfriends are that she's naming off in the song. So I think like those are good examples of the effect that streaming had on the way that popular music sounds and the types of creative choices that artists are making to try to stay in that sweet spot of things that work on this platform.
Around this time that we're talking about, really like the mid-2010s, moving into the late 2010s, and it feels heretical even to say it now, and I feel my good friend Liz Pelly is going to come out of my closet and stab me in the neck for saying this. But like, I did have a moment where I was like, does it make more sense to not review individual albums, but to review playlists? And obviously acknowledging that they are corporately structured, that they are funded implicitly or explicitly by major labels. But to look at a playlist the same way you might look at what is a Z100 play in a given 24-hour period, what does it tell us about the state of hip hop, the state of country, the state of pop music, that the prioritized music in any given week or month is this assemblage with all of the kind of caveats that would go with that? There was a stretch of time where I thought hard about, is that a way to try to earnestly engage with what's happening in this moment, more so than saying, hey, so-and-so's fourth album, so-and-so's seventh album, so-and-so's third album, because that was beginning to feel futile. And I wonder, even now, I feel awkward even just mentioning that, but I wonder what you take of an idea like that. And thinking of, again, it's not exactly what you say in your tweet, which is about scene, which is has the tactile component of human interaction, I presume, although plenty of scenes are internet native. We don't want to discount those scenes, but it is a way to think about how a sound is evolving and keeping, while keeping in mind the corporate interests that have invested in that particular evolution of the sound. Is that a valid direction for critical inquiry?
I think what I, Jamie Brooks, would say is
that's why you're here.
I'm trying to think about when I'm writing, I'm thinking about what the reader would say, or I'm trying to consider like all the different people involved. But what I would say is that I think the playlist is deficient in a way that albums were not during the era where like people paid for music. Like that era is gone. We can't go back. So it's not that I'm arguing that one thing is better than another thing. Like something broke like deep in the machinery of it all when we switched over from buying music to buying access to music. Like I think like the implications of this shift, not just in music, but in basically every cloud-based industry are going to like there has been much sowing and there will be like more reaping than perhaps many are expecting. So I think that reviewing playlists is not necessarily like a way forward, because I think something like the Spotify Hyperpop playlist, like how long was that really going on? And like how much of that was really like anything? Like the people who got signed to majors like off of that playlist, like nothing happened with any of it. Like I'm personally of the opinion that like
put some respect on Glaive's name. Jeez.
How many records did Glaive sell? Like in all seriousness, like how many records did Glaive sell?
No, I understand, but to me the key thing about someone like Glaive is that by the time Glaive entered into that ecosystem, he already moved on aesthetically to a different place.
Yeah, well, yeah, and that's maybe pointing at like the deficiency of what hyperpop is. Like, where's the party? Like, what is it really? What does it signify? Is it really a scene, or is it just like a target that like, you know, somebody at Spotify painted on a wall and said, you know, throw some tomatoes at this, like maybe something will stick. I think that like ultimately like
I think that person is a podcast listener. I feel like I got an email.
Oh yeah, Glenn McDonald. Hey, you know, looking forward to your book. But yeah, like I think that like, you know, those playlists, like those scene based playlist, like it doesn't guarantee that there's anything actually going on behind whatever Spotify says is going on with their name and their little blurb or whatever. That's why dance hall and hip hop and like all these genres or baile funk, this stuff is more interesting because there's actual culture there. There's a real party. Like these songs are being played like in rooms where people are making memories and like making culture and making people.
But on some level, people are making memories and making culture without being in the actual same rooms. I'm not saying the shared room that they're in is a Spotify playlist, but I'm saying there are like internet native subcultures where people are making memories that
I'm skeptical of that. Like I'm skeptical of like how much of that is really going on. And I mean, like a lot of that stuff is happening like on top of platforms that are like fundamentally like in unstable, like in ways that people are only starting to process now, like Bandcamp or Discord, like, you know, like Discord's making all these huge changes. And that's a huge, big central beating heart, like of a lot of the online native scenes that popped up around the pandemic time. Like very little of that stuff lasted. I've heard more stories about like those kinds of scenes, like spectacularly imploding than I have about like any of it producing something that like, you know, makes me go like, oh, I wish I was there for that, or I wish I, you know, was part of that.
And it's interesting because I guess the long lastingness of a thing like that doesn't seem to me to be the primary driver or indicator of its importance. I think there's so many kind of like micro bursts of innovation that ultimately fizzle, but maybe set the table for another thing or birth one or two individuals who then go off and create something in a slightly different milieu. I guess to me, I'm not too stressed if the hyperpop moment produced, you know, a great album / EP / set of singles / playlist, as much as did it collectively potentially inspire a generation of people to make music on an unusual set of terms. Now, obviously, I don't know that. We're still like 10 or 20 years away, I think, from being able to assess that. I don't know that it's totally discountable.
What if recordings, what if it's not like a consistently self-replicating project? What if the audience doesn't necessarily have infinite patience and infinite capacity to care about every possible permutation of creative decisions that can happen in the context of recordings? What if there's a point where it's people are like, okay, there's been enough new genres, there's been enough new sound. Like this new like hybrid of like nightcore and plug and whatever that is going on. What if there's just never going to be like a big audience for that, like there was for rock and roll and hip hop and reggaeton? And what if it's diminishing returns? Like, what if there's never going to be like another Nirvana that comes out of these digital scenes or whatever? What if, as far as the market is concerned, like most of the stuff that like people are making like on their DAWs, like with their democratized like infinite ability to make like recorded music, what if the market always views that stuff as trash? Like, then the whole premise of these like little scene playlists that flame out and implode like very quickly is like kind of fraudulent. There's no party there.
And are you saying that the impermanence is a kind of essential and necessary byproduct of the medium itself? Because again, the impermanence to me is not inherently problematic, but are you saying that impermanence and the diminished potential for that level of import is something that's a fundamental offshoot / byproduct of the fact that it exists only in a sort of streaming ecosystem?
Yeah, I think the process of consuming music has changed so much, but the process of making it has changed also. Something that has changed a lot since 20 or 30 years ago is like a lot of people are making records by themselves, like literally by themselves, like in a dark room alone. And I feel like the implications of that are like not often thought about, because like those of us who care about music from whatever angle we're doing it, we all probably know people that spend a lot of time like alone in their rooms making stuff, like being producers, like or being artists or whatever. And it's, I don't know that the market has ever really shown that like in the streaming era or like after a certain point in time, that there's like an enormous amount of demand for that stuff, like for that type of expression. If you think about like the Bob Dylan in the early 60s, like, you know, like one of the first people that kind of breaks into the mainstream firmament with an album entirely or mostly of their own songs, like he's still alive. He's still touring. This hasn't been going on that long. The whole idea of the recording artist is somebody who sits in a room by themselves and like makes recordings of themselves, and the rest of us are supposed to see that like this type of expression is interesting and valuable and important by default. Like, I don't know that like in the streaming era, people are still seeing it that way. Like, I think that like the question of scarcity, like, you know, especially like in a capitalist society that we all live in, where market forces are like shaping like every aspect of our living experience, whether we want it or not. Like, we have to ask ourselves, does this stuff have value? Should we continue acting like this stuff has value? Should we continue to take this idea of the album with us into the future when so much of the machinery underneath it has changed or been hollowed out or rusted away?
Going back to the kind of entry conversation about how to cover music in this particular moment, is the music criticism or music journalism that is best suited to cover this kind of music, which is to say potentially ephemeral on unshaky ground, is the journalism / criticism meant to formalize it and strengthen it? Or is it also fundamentally an ephemeral task or a task destined or doomed to ephemerality?
It looks like it's vaporizing, like the amount of jobs that there are to be doing that kind of writing as a professional vocation seems to be going away. So I think the market has already answered that question. I don't know how much longer the market is going to justify like the amount of money that currently gets spent like paying people to review albums, especially like albums like that are below a certain level of notoriety. One of my other like pet things that I like to follow is what happened with Mitski during the pandemic. Like, you know, Mitski's like your classic artist, independent label in the 2010s, like very critically acclaimed, like hard to imagine, like another like American independent artist that was like getting strong critical notices, like all through her early career, like she was. And it didn't get her like over the moat. It didn't get her in front of the audience that now has a song of hers like on the Hot 100. Here's an artist who is like apparently capable of writing Hot 100 hits, like, you know, on an independent label, like an American independent label. And like the whole ecosystem, like around like these prestige, like NPR core albums, like all the noise that they were making, like didn't get it over the moat. People like recommending it to each other, person to person, like on TikTok, like during the pandemic and slightly before, that seems to be what got her in front of this audience that is now like actively buying her records, going to her shows, like listening to streaming her music. So it's like, I think that there's a lot of changes that have happened, like in terms of the lot of signs that the criticism as we know it, like is disappearing, like is corroding.
For many years, whether me here at the Times or when I was freelancing previously, again, I think I used the term earlier, unit criticism. And to me, even like a live review is a unit criticism. An album review is, unit criticism. Even a single review to some degree. And often I felt like I was trying to jam, sometimes successfully, sometimes less, a more holistic way of thinking about that artist or that sound or that scene into the unit of criticism. And again, sometimes successful, sometimes less. But unless the artist themselves is moving with purpose, really trying to evolve moment to moment, song to song, album to album, say something different on the fifth album than on the fourth album, say something different in 2023 than in 2021 or 2019, this microscopic focus on the album or the artist's new music as a reflection of the artist it feels decreasingly worthwhile to me. And I also feel like I've been looking for other pathways. I think writing about scenes is really valuable. When I was a freelancer and doing more, I would try to report on scenes. Alphonse at Pitchfork did a big thing on Milwaukee rap recently. That's a scene that should be taken in full, not simply by individual recordings. But candidly, there's not how many of those, like how many Milwaukee rap scenes are there in 2023? Like at that level of sonic maturity, stylistic innovation, is it 3? Is it 10? Is it 20? I'm not even trying to be like funny or like dismissive. I listen to a lot of music from a lot of different places of a lot of different styles. And maybe there's 3 Milwaukee raps right now. Maybe. And if you're willing to be a little bit more forgiving about the quality of the music and just take the scene as the primary point of interest, maybe you get double that. Places where maybe, I don't know if the music is of the peak quality, but at least they're trying something interesting. 6, 10? Maybe it's 10.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a lot. I feel like at this moment in time, like my suggestion that what if there's not like an infinite capacity in the audience for interest in new recordings? What if at one point there's like too many? I think that the way that would look if it were true right now is that in terms of English music, there are a lot of recordings of music in English. That would mean that the ground that is left to be covered would be outside of the Anglosphere, outside of English language music. And that kind of seems to be what's going on. Increasingly, people in your position who just want to write about stuff that is going on, like the stuff that's really happening culturally, a lot of that might end up being like covering this stuff that is increasingly happening like outside of the Anglosphere and maybe outside of the American market. The Brazilian Spotify user base is almost as big as the American user base. And some of these countries are growing like a lot faster than America is, and use of the streaming platforms is growing there. So, you know, it's not unfeasible that in the next like 10, 20 years, there's going to be more listeners like in other countries. And so maybe that's going to be where the lead is taken creatively. It's people that are coming out of America. Like maybe they're going to be like following the innovations that are coming from other places.
That to me seems undeniable. I mean, I feel like 10 years ago, I would have said you couldn't really be like a mainstream pop critic doing a job like mine if you didn't properly understand the importance of hip hop, broadly speaking, and its influence on pop music throughout the 80s and 90s and 2000s. But I think moving forward, that includes reggaeton, that includes regional Mexican music, that includes K-pop, that includes Afrobeats. It's actually the way that a lot of those sounds and regions are, at least in part, synthesizing some of the innovations from American music and then now sending it back better with a different set of influences and amplified and frankly synthesizing so much faster than I feel people are synthesizing here in this country. And I think if you're really paying attention, my hope is that should someone have the job of pop music critic 10 years from now, God willing, I mean, who knows, right? Like it could just very simply be that it doesn't exist. But I think if it does exist 10 years from now, then that's what I hope that person is listening to right now.
One of the responses that I remember seeing from the initial tweet that I made was people talking about how album reviews are one of the last bastions of what I think somebody called non-stan journalism. And I think it's entirely possible that whoever, like people who get hired as part of the NYT music team in 10 years, like maybe they are coming at it from the celebrity angle more. Like maybe that's like the direction that they're coming at it from and they have no connection to like the continuum of criticism, like, you know, from the old days of the jazz mags, like up through the current situation.
I hope that that's not the case. I hope that's not the case. But, you know, the dispirited frustration, the tone of frustration, like it's something that I don't talk about a lot on this show necessarily, but it's something that I think about a lot every single week, every single day. And it is my hope, whether it's through conversations on the show or just talking to younger writers, that there will be a generation to pick up the slack. And I do meet people all the time who I think are doing great work. I just hope the systems will be there to support those people as they get more ambitious and their ideas are not as centrist and celebrity focused as I think the streaming ecosystem has pushed people towards.
Yeah, you know, I guess we just have to hope that whoever owns the media publications and stuff cares about these things more than chasing the bottom line.
Well, that case seems pretty unlikely.
Yes.
Jamie, I'm so happy we got to talk. I feel like we could have done this for many hours. We at least peeled the Band-Aid back. What can I say? Okay, before we go out, is there a song or scene, or is there something we should play at the end that you think people should be paying attention to?
People should be paying attention to right now?
Give people a little excitement. Give people a little smelling salts.
Honestly, the only thing that I can think of that I want to hear right now, which is the exact opposite of what you just asked me for, is I Love You Poppy by Jennifer Lopez, which I think is a super underrated song.
And maybe the music journalism of 10 to 20 years from now will have finally come up with the language to properly assess this song's quality.
Yeah, let's hope so. That's the dream.
Okay. That's our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Podcast Deluxe is on YouTube. It's at tinyurl.com/podcastdeluxe. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. Get in the Discord and the Facebook, tinyurl.com/podcast Discord/podcast Facebook. Subscribe to podcast anywhere you get your audio content. That is Spotify, Apple, increasingly YouTube, and so on. We will be back next week. This is Jennifer Lopez. I Love You, Poppy. An underappreciated gem. Thank you, Jamie.
Thanks.
I put it down for a brother like you. Give it to you right in the car, that's you. We could first give you some of this, that's you. And you're all out loving that J-Love true. Hold up. I can get you a gun off. Pull your trigger. Go and get your gun off on my time. I